Thank you.
Well, comparing Randy. So my first question, I want to first of all ask a question about this book. It's called Practical Buddhism. Is there any such thing as anything but practical Buddhism? isn't that the whole point?
Well, and that's why we need the book. I think the thing is, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, theories and, you know, if you look at the Buddhist canonical texts, I mean, they're just vast. I mean, they're really, really huge. And particularly as Buddhism developed, you get more and more sort of elaborate metaphysics. But actually, what it is really about is a practical approach to life. And I suppose that's what I wanted to, in a way, emphasise, or if you like, re-emphasise. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly in my own, my own spiritual life, I've always, when I've met a teaching, I've always wanted to know, well, how can, you know, what's the relevance of this to my life? I've got less interest in the sort of abstract metaphysics of things, and much more in terms of just how I can use this. So, hence the title.
That's why it's called practical.
That's why it's called practical, yes. Yeah.
So in the book, you do talk a bit about your own spiritual life. Perhaps you might introduce how you got involved, because one of the things that's striking about the book is your very commonsensical approach to Buddhism, coming from your own life. You know, what drew you to Buddhism? In a certain sense, you're slightly unlikely. I'm much more likely, frankly, being the moody type. But you're a slightly sort of unlikely Buddhist in some ways. So perhaps tell us a little bit about how you got involved in Buddhism. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, as you said earlier on, so I was a medical student at the time when I first got involved. And, I mean, in a way, the backtrack to that is I've always had a strong, in a way, drive for finding meaning in my life. I went to university. My closest friends were studying things like English, history, basically the art subjects. And you know, they were quite influenced by existential ideas, and their take on finding meaning was to find meaning through creativity. So they were into things like, you know, I'm going to write a great novel, and you know, indeed that friend has written a couple of novels. Someone else was going to write poetry, and I was studying anatomy, biochemistry, physiology, which frankly I didn't find very creative and rather slightly dull. So
it doesn't mean that personally.
Yes, for any anatomists out there. But I suppose what I started getting interested in was the idea of being creative with who I was as a person, and became more and more interested in the whole sort of movement around that time of personal development, for want of a better phrase. So as I moved to London and continued with my medical studies, I got interested in things like psychotherapy. I took on there was a student psychotherapy scheme where I trained so I could take on a patient for psychotherapy. Got interested in other things like yoga, and meditation seemed like a good idea as part of that. And around that time, I met someone who was a Buddhist, and he got me interested in the idea of using meditation as part of that. So it was really through him. He was actually meditating with a different tradition, but then he met somebody who was associated with this tradition, and it sounded quite interesting. So in 1984, I rocked up at the Wednesday class in at this centre, in the LBC. So that was really how it started. And, yeah, I just got more interested. And particularly in the Dharma, I really struggled with meditation to begin with for, 2 years. Don't be put off. I didn't really get very far or get on very well with meditation. But actually, Buddhism really spoke to me increasingly, and that just started to sort of, in a way, shape and orientate my life.
You mentioned that the Dharma, and then Buddhism. Is there a difference between Buddhism and the Dharma? What do you see a difference? What do you mean by the Dharma?
So the Dharma is, there's a few meanings to Dharma. Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. The Dharma is also the truth or the reality that the Buddha was pointing towards, that he realised in his own experience. And sometimes we do make a distinction between the Dharma, which is sort of that sort of truth, which is perennial, and particular formulations of it, which we can think of as Buddhism. And as I think I mentioned somewhere in the book, you know, there may be things that don't formally have a Buddhist tag on them that are the Dharma insofar as they conduce to liberation, to freedom, to kindness and so on, to wisdom. And similarly, there are some things that one might argue are Buddhist but not really the Dharma. But we'll just put that to one side for a minute.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the structure of the book, because in a way, the structure of the book for it's a practical Buddhism book is a slightly unusual, because you start with meditation and then you sort of go back to ethics. Traditionally, the path in Buddhism is often described as a threefold path, which is ethics, meditation and wisdom. You start with meditation. Could you say a bit why you chose
that? In a way, I suppose it's just going on my experience and people I've taught, particularly like at, you know, this class. I don't currently teach at the Wednesday class, but I have taught here and, you know, to continue to teach meditation. So for many people, their first introduction to Buddhism is through meditation. So in a way, that was really in my mind when I was writing the book. So actually the first chapter is about the Buddha, and just a sort of a bit of a historical context to kind of frame it, because it's a bit like, well, you know, if you've come here to learn to meditate, you have actually come to the London Buddhist Centre. As Maitreya Banda was saying, there's a great big figure there. Mm. When I first used to come along here, we were much more wary about mentioning, you know, if it was a Buddhist centre and that we taught Buddhist meditation. So as a part of that is we didn't used to light the candles, as though, you know, if we didn't light the candles, then no one would know the big Buddhist figure there. Anyway, those days are gone. For many of us, certainly for myself and for many people, their first introduction or way into Buddhism is through meditation. So that's where I wanted to start, and really go into that in some detail, and then go into some of the major areas that are important in Buddhism. So friendship, ethics, ritual, some of the chapters.
I mean, in the chapter on meditation, one of the things that you're quite keen to do is dispel some of the misconceptions about meditation. Perhaps you could, because some people might have them. So I wonder whether it might be interesting. I mean, I remember you've taught at this class for a good few years. Mm. Say something about the misconceptions that people can have or do have often about meditation.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the commonest ones is, so like tonight we're doing the mindfulness of breathing, I presume. We were in my room, you were in this room. So, you know, we get taught to bring our attention onto the breath. And even when we teach it very carefully, it's very easy to sort of feel that if your mind wanders off, that you're somehow failing at the meditation. It's very easy to feel that somehow as though your mind should be glued onto the breath in order to be successful at meditation. And, you know, it really isn't about that, because in a sense what mindfulness is really about is awareness. What we're trying to develop is more awareness. We're trying to really find out about who we are more and more fully. And that includes, you know, the mind's tendency to wander off. In fact, the mind's tendency to wander off is full of interesting information, because it starts to show us what our mind wants to do, what our basic tendencies are. We can learn, in a way, much more from our mind wandering off than, in some ways, from just paying attention, you know, just being, as it were, stuck on the breath. So that was one of the things that I go into in the book, because it is people, what can so easily happen is you come along to meditation, and you start meditating, you follow the instructions to follow the breath, you just think, well, my mind's just going all over the place, I can't do this, and then you give up. And, you know, that's a real pity, because that is just what human minds do. They go off. And there's lots, as I said, we can learn in that. So that was one of the things I particularly wanted to emphasise.
I mean, the other thing I wanted to, you talk about meditation, then you talk about, you know, you then go on to talk about ethics. Ethics is a sort of quite a difficult thing to talk about in a way, because even the word ethics sounds rather academic now. as if it's a kind of philosophical system, or it sounds a bit of sort of put off, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you say something about why Buddhism emphasises ethics and what makes Buddhist ethics particular? What's important about ethics in a way? Many of us, I think, want to get away from all that and just sort of enjoy ourselves.
Yeah, indeed.
Shouldn't seem unreasonable.
Fair enough, isn't it, really? I mean, in a way, I think, in a sense, the simplest aspect of ethics is just seeing that our actions will have consequences. And in a way, what the Buddha recommended us to do is just to pay attention to our minds, to our speech, and to our physical actions, and see what the effect is. And, you know, in a way, we don't need a sort of abstract ruling. We can just pay attention to that, and we can see the effects that it will have. And so what Buddhism describes, put simply, is that if we act with an intention that is, for example, kind, that has an aspect of clarity to it, it will have a beneficial effect on us. If it has, if our mind state is full of ill will or cloudiness, or it's grasping, then that's going to have an adverse effect on us. And in some ways, it's as simple as that. Simple to perhaps explain, to then actually start putting into practice, of course, is a little bit more challenging. But in a way, that's a basic foundation of ethics, and it's something we can check out in our own experience. One of the things I love about the Dharma is it's very much an invitation to try it in your own experience. It's like, you know, don't take my word, don't take Maitreya Bandhu's word, don't even take the Buddha's word. Test it out for yourself, check it out for yourself, and see what the effect is. So it's not like there's some, you know, external figure saying that this is good and this is bad, and you must do this and you mustn't do that, and usually the things that you mustn't do are things you want to do, and the things that, you know, vice versa. It's really just pay attention to your experience. Just notice what happens in your mind. Just notice what the results are of the actions.
It's interesting that, because I think quite often people, when you talk about ethics, think in terms of, so it's going to end up being about sex. Mm. It's one of you, that's one of the things you often
we
want
have,
to do.
Don't
I mean,
we?
I don't, perhaps nobody does, but people sometimes want to do that. And I think sometimes people think that, oh, that's really where it's going. Can you say something about Buddhism's attitude to sexual ethics? Might be something of interest. As long as you're yawning.
Possibly not. I mean, in a way, the same principle applies. Of, you know, in one's relationships, one's trying to practice those, or bring into being those mental states of kindness, of clarity, of contentment. So, in a way, you know, what the Buddha recommended is that, you know, however we, you know, whether we're single or whether we're in a relationship, that we try and have a quality of contentment to that. And, you know, in terms of how we relate to other people, you know, one of the fundamental, you know, principles of Buddhism is non-violence. So that's got lots of ramifications if we try and, you know, sort of think that through. But we can think of that's, you know, the fundamental thing that we're trying to bring to our you know, our relationships, including our sexual relationships, practicing non-violence. So then, other things that that's a fundamental thing. What you do, I mean, in the sense of, you know, whether you're straight or you're gay, or, you know, even traditionally in Buddhism, whether you have more than, you know, whether you're monogamous or polygamous, as long as it's done on the basis of non-violence, that is the most important thing. It doesn't sort of matter, in a sense, what form your sexual relationship takes.
Well, let's not dwell on it, eh? moving on then. One of the things that you very much pioneered here at the London Buddhist Centre is you're the director of Breathing Space. You've been teaching MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and you've even developed KBT, Kindness Behaviour Training, and MBSR, no, you haven't, MBRP, which is mindfulness-based relapse prevention for drugs and alcohol. There's been a lot of interest in mindfulness-based therapies. It's something that you very much brought to the centre in the last few years. Can you say something about those approaches to mindfulness and how you bring that into, because you do also write about that whole sort of new interest in a way in mindfulness in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very now, isn't it, mindfulness? It's really become very, very popular, and certainly in the National Health Service where I work, but also I keep coming across it all over the place. I met with somebody from Mindful Leadership this week, so again, sort of bringing mindfulness into working with chief executives and people like that. It's become a very big thing in the last 10 years, and in this country for longer over in America. And really, I mean, it basically comes out of work of somebody called Kabat-Zinn in America, who started a thing called the Stress Clinic, and he took people with chronic pain, who Western medicine could not do much more for, and found that an 8-week course of mindfulness really made a difference to them. It helped them to manage their pain much better. That didn't really catch on over here until Maitra Bandra was mentioning MBCT, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, which was really, to cut a long story short, applying the same principles that Kabat-Zinn had developed using mindfulness, but in this case to work with depression. And the easy three-step version of these mindfulness-based approaches, because it's now used as well, as I mentioned, for addiction, but also for eating disorders, for anxiety, for lots of different conditions. It's been more and more widely used. So the three steps are, first of all, learning to pay attention, so learning to develop awareness of what is going on in our minds, in our bodies. So if we don't have awareness, then we can't really change something. We'll just get caught up in our habits. The second thing, which is really the crux part of it, is learning to be with our experience, or learning to turn towards, accept our experience, particularly when that is difficult. Because so easily what happens is, if we're having, experiencing major anxiety, or if we've got pain, the last thing we want to do is experience it. We kind of just want to push it away. That's a sort of natural response. But unfortunately, that has the effect usually of making it worse. It's kind of the thing like, don't think about a pink elephant. And you're busily thinking about pink elephants. You try and push it away, and it tends to make it worse. So the crux part of these mindfulness-based approaches is to turn towards your experience. And then on the basis of that, you're in a much better position to make the third step, which is making a wise choice, so choosing what to do. So you've got this ABC, awareness, being with, wise choices. And so that's, really important, really useful in things like for depression, anxiety, chronic pain and so on. But actually, it's very good just in, even if you don't suffer from those things, just in our meditation generally. So, just by virtue of being a human, even if you don't have major suffering in your life, there's always going to be some difficulty showing up sometime or another. And really, this mindfulness can be very helpful in how we approach that, in responding to the troubles that life will throw at us and does throw at us. So the first chapter on meditation is about mindfulness, but the second chapter is more about this learning to turn towards difficulties, sort of finding skillful ways of responding to difficulties in our experience, whether that's depression, or whether that's severe depression, or whether that's less marked, less severe, less painful.
I mean, I think that work has been very, very important. We've had a lot of people come to the centre to do MBCT courses or mindfulness-based practices. I suppose one of the things that you bring into your book and which people can find really surprising about Buddhism and even feel a bit disappointed is that Buddhism also includes a ritual element. So I don't think the mindfulness world will ever be able to adopt this, if you see me. But ritual devotion, the non-rational, the imaginative, but yeah, it's very much a kind of ritual aspect of Buddhism has always been central to Buddhism, and it's something that you talk about in this book. Could you, I mean, for a lot of people that would feel very unusual, you know, why ritual, why does Buddhism have ritual? If Buddhism doesn't have a god, which we assume it doesn't, yeah. You know, why ritual and so on?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the simple, you know, thing is, I mean, in a way, what rituals are about is a way of, you know, underlining our experience. So, my niece there is going to get married in the summertime, and that's a ritual, actually. Mm. You know, that's is her fiancé. So that's a celebration and a ritual to mark something that's really important to them. So, in a way, it's just the same basic principle that, you know, if you've committed your life, particularly if you've committed your life to the Dharma, to Buddhism, and wanting to really pursue that, then doing things that, in a way, help to underline it, if you like, that help to reinforce to yourself what you're about, that, in a way, touches other parts of you, not just the rational, because actually our rational is only very sort of kind of surface level. We've got these strong, deep channels within us, and they need to be brought into the Dharma if that's what we want to do with our lives. So, for that reason, you know, ritual is very important. I was in India just recently, there was a big order convention, so there were about 450 of us order members there, and we were we went to Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and there was something just very magical about being in this place where 2,500 years ago the Buddha gained awakening, gained enlightenment, and just being there meditating together, but also doing ritual together, doing chanting mantras together there. There was something which is really quite hard to put in words, but there was just a real quality of magic there that was just very, very moving and just very, very uplifting. And I think ritual at its best, that's what it can do. It can really move you and it can really uplift you. And as Maitreya Bandhu said, it's always been a part of Buddhism. It's always been, in fact, it's part of all religions, actually, pretty much. But certainly if it's part of Buddhism, and an important part.
And do you have any sense why people are so uneasy about it? I mean, you come from a very strongly science background, but I can't remember you ever feeling particularly uneasy about it. But I do meet people again and again who really sort of struggle with it, or feel very, very uneasy about it.
Well, I think partly, I mean, ritual has a real power. So I think, you know, if it's used untowardly, you know, it can have quite a negative, you know, negative effect in potential. So I think that's that. But I think the other thing is that, you know, certainly for me, ritual, or I think for a lot of people, and initially for me, I think ritual for me was associated with blind belief. So in other words, that you just had to take something on and you were just told this is true and this is what you had to do. This is, you know, for me, my, I suppose, early experience of the, you know, Church of England. And I didn't like that. I didn't like this idea of just taking something on blind belief. So I think, you know, in our relatively secular society, I think quite a lot of people, you know, have that sort of feeling. And I think that's why I can make people a bit wary of ritual, almost, because it can feel as though you're sort of parking your brain and leaving outside the door, as it were, whilst you go off and do these mad things, sort of throwing yourself on the floor and so on, as though you've left your brain behind. But actually, real ritual, it's not like that. Certainly in Buddhism, it very much it includes the rational, but it includes more than that. Mm. So it's not like you leave your thinking faculty outside of the door.
Mm. And then just going, you know, sort of near the end of the book, one of the things you're pains to do in the book is be practical, because it's called Practical Buddhism, so it seems reasonable. You're pains to be very straightforward, I think, about what Buddhism is. You don't use technical language. You don't go on and on.
Slim volume.
Some people I know, like me, are very slim. It's very concise. It's a very sensible, very sane book. One of the things you then move on to is wisdom, which isn't, in a way, is more than that. You know, I think it's very easy. One of my concerns, I suppose, is that Buddhism gets reduced to mindfulness, or reduced to an idea, a current idea of mindfulness, in a way that it gets reduced in a way to something that is merely practical, like a kind of philosophy, which is just to do with being in the moment and so on, which is just to do with, which really has no content, I think, as an idea. But Buddhist wisdom, difficult though it is to talk about, goes way beyond all that. Can you try and say something about Buddhist wisdom?
Okay. in a way, that's what that's what Buddhism is pointing towards, ultimately. I mean, if we go back to the historical Buddha, he was on a quest. He, in particular, saw the frailty of life, saw the suffering inherent in life, such as old age, the fact that we grow old, the fact that we inevitably will die, and in a way wanted to find a solution to those sort of existential questions. You know, what, in a sense, what is life about? You know, we're in the face of the fact that we will get sick, we will get old, we will die. And his understanding, his wisdom, is in a way pointing to, if you like, a solution to that. And so, in particular, the Buddha talked about, I suppose what one has to realise is that, so the Buddha faced these questions and gained something that we call enlightenment or awakening. And that is a state that actually goes beyond words. So any words that I use is going to be an approximation, as it were. So it's actually pointing to an experience of liberation, an experience of wisdom and compassion. But to try and put that into words, one way of thinking about Buddhist wisdom is what I call the three marks. And again, they're something I go into in the book. So there's three aspects of how things are, which are that things are impermanent, so they change. They're insubstantial, so there's not a core essence. And suffering. So I'll just say a little bit about those three. So in a way, the first is perhaps the easiest to approach, so impermanent, so everything changes. That is just how things are. But our tendency is, although we know that, at one level we know it. I mean, if I ask you to put up your hand and say, does anyone here believe that things aren't impermanent? Probably, wouldn't put your hand up which way ever around that is. that's fairly obvious. But the thing is, we behave in ways as though things were permanent. Very, very easily. I mean, just even on simple levels, one of the things I was writing about in the book was when I did this solitary retreat in New Zealand, and I was sort of doing some, in my mind, profound reflection. And at the same time, a bit of me was going, oh, how nice, it's a sunny day today, that's really nice, oh, that's very good, I'll be able to go and sit on the balcony and, da da da. And then it clouded over, and my mind was going, oh dear, it's a horrible day now today, it's really, cloudy and miserable. And then it changed again, it went back to being sunny again. But it was like each time my mind was predicting, because it was sunny now, my mind was assuming it was just going to stay sunny all the time. Even though this was New Zealand, which has a climate pretty much like the UK, where it just changes all the time. So you know, just on that level, my mind was imputing permanence, was assuming that things would be permanent. And we just do that all the time. And then when it doesn't go, when it changes, and particularly when it doesn't change the way we don't like it, that's when we suffer, which was the third mark. But I'll come back to that in a moment. So first of all, I just think that things are changing all the time. And we can cause ourselves suffering if we assume things to be permanent. The good thing, of course, about impermanence is that we can change, you know, which comes back to how I got involved in the Dharma in the first place. Mm. I wanted to change, not because I was particularly unhappy, but I felt there was potential for more, as it were. So we can change. Now, the second thing, the second mark of conditioned existence is what's referred to as insubstantiality. It's also called egolessness or non-selfhood. It's got a variety of terms. But the basic idea is that nothing has a fixed core to it. We don't have fixed core to it. Paramabandhu doesn't have a fixed core. As Maitreya-bandhu, neither does this chair that I'm sitting on. And that is because everything's changing all the time. So there's not a sort of an essence of Paramabandhu that sits outside of this changing process of thoughts and emotions, of aging body, of all the rest of it that makes up me or makes up you, or indeed all the things around us. But again, a bit like with impermanence, we can very easily assume that we have got an essence or a fixed self, which we then end up trying to defend. I mean, you get an example of this. Actually, looking around the room, you're all pretty young, aren't you? But I was going to say, if you retire, so what quite often happens is when, you know, if we have a job, and particularly if you have a career, it's very easy to get identified with that, like I am a psychiatrist. And we, you know, attach onto that label. But then when that changes, so like when I retire, so I'm no longer a psychiatrist. And if the more that I've attached to that or held that as this is who I really am, then the more I will suffer. So again, it comes to this third thing. So the more that we fix or identify strongly with aspects of us as this is who we really are, then the more we will suffer. And again, it's just a very easy thing to do that, you know, we do, you know, in a sense unconsciously all the time. Mm. And, you know, it's useful that I can remember that I'm a psychiatrist, and that's sort of probably useful when I go to work tomorrow that I remember that. But that's not the problem. The label's not the problem. It's the fixing to it, holding on to it. And what this thing about insubstantiality is pointing to is that actually it's just coreless. So there's just this, in a way, who we really are is quite open and fluid. Again, it relates to this thing of impermanence. And the more that we can open up to that fluidity, the more we will find freedom. And what seems to happen as well is because we're not holding ourselves in a particular way, it can allow kindness, it can allow compassion to flow. Because in a way, that's a sort of natural response that comes out if we're not trying to hold ourselves in a particular way and defend ourselves as being, you know, a special person or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, we hold ourselves, whatever way we hold ourselves. So that's wisdom. Well, the third one, in a way, I've sort of touched on to. So the third one is unsatisfactoriness or suffering, which is, it's partly just saying that, you know, things change and if you try and hold on to things, you will suffer. Things are insubstantial. If you try and hold on to a fixed core, think you've got, or identify with something in that way, you will suffer. Another way of thinking about it is just simply, you know, we can't escape some suffering. You know, the fact we have a body means we will sometimes experience pleasure and sometimes experience pain. You know, we can't avoid that. But we can learn to relate to that in a wise way, in a way that doesn't add to our suffering. And again, that's what this is sort of, in a sense, pointing to.
And just finally, just carrying on from that, because I think the other thing that I think I notice is that people think that Buddhism's very good. They think, okay, you just see that things are impermanent. You kind of go with the flow. You seem to be, but it sounds rather sort of stoical. It could sound rather philosophical that you see things more accurately in a rather cool way. But really, the Buddha figure behind us is trying to point to what arises when you see that things are impermanent. It's not just a sort of cool assent to things being impermanent and insubstantial, but something completely new arising. I just wonder whether we can finish talking about that, because I think people don't know about that. They can think that Buddhism is just a sort of a common sense thing, but it doesn't have this arising of what other traditions would call, I don't know, the miraculous or the mystical or the or even Godhead.
I mean, in a way, I think I was slightly pointing to that with this idea that if we can turn towards change, if we can recognise that we're a fluid, coreless being, then in a way something a bit magical can happen, even something a bit mysterious can happen. And I was speaking a moment ago in terms of kindness and compassion. So, when we think about the Buddha, we think of particularly having two main qualities. So one is wisdom, which is this seeing, understanding, impermanence, insubstantiality, and so on. But the other side is this flowering of compassion, this very beautiful movement of, love and wanting to, sort of just naturally responding in terms of wanting to alleviate the suffering in the world. In a way, that's the sort of what flowers, what emerges, the more fully we can contact this wisdom, the more really we can, more deeply we can see this. So in one way that it's talked about, there are different ways of talking about it, but one way of talking about it in terms of the Bodhisattva. So a Bodhisattva is a sort of archetypal figure that, if you like, embodies the qualities of the awakened mind, or particularly draws out particular aspects, so like love or compassion or wisdom or energy. And so one of the things that, Maitreya Bandhu and I do, and other people in the order, is we meditate on these figures. I meditate on a figure called Manjushri, which is a bodhisattva that's particularly associated with wisdom. And so just to sort of describe that, just to maybe give you a little bit of a flavour. So Manjushri holds a sword, and that sword is particularly, it's a flaming sword, and it's particularly associated with cutting through our confusion. So it's like cutting through to get really to the core of things. In his other hand, he holds a book of, and this is a book called The Perfection of Wisdom. So he holds wisdom right to his heart. So in a sense, his heart is just wisdom. But then the colour of Manjushri, so he's a beautiful figure, a beautiful youth, and his colour is a sort of amber. It's said to be the colour of a lion's eye or sunlight through honey. And it's a very warm colour. And I think it's that lovely contrast of, on the one hand, there's this very precise wisdom that just cuts through and just gets really to the point. But at the same time, it's got this gorgeous warmth, this very just really sort of filling, it's almost like fills your body with this sense of warmth and kindness that makes quite a contrast with that sort of cool cutting through. So I think maybe that just gives a little flavour of the sort of what might start to emerge if one really practices the Dharma, and this is sort of where it's pointing towards.
phrase, interesting, as soon as you talk about what arises after you see through selfhood, you have to use images, you have to use poetry, you have to use story and so on. So, we're just coming to a close, but just, I just really recommend the book. It's $9.95, if I'm correct.
$9.95.
I think what I've been thinking and looking at it in, and reading it is that books obviously express their author. Parambandhu, I've known Parambandhu for many, many years, and actually he's usually a man of a few words, but I told him tonight, I want you to say more. I said, when I ask you questions, I'm going to ask, I want you to say more, so just say, speak. Usually he's, he's not quite a man of few words, but he chooses his words very carefully, and he can say a lot in a short period of time. He's very epigrammatic, not quite the right word. Anyway, you know what I mean. He can say a lot in a short time. So this book is very beautifully written. It's very simply written. It's very accessible and clear and lucid. It's not technical. It's not convoluted. It just takes a very clean and clear line into Buddhism, into our human life, and really simply says, here's how you can flourish it. Here's how you can make more of your life. Yeah. So I really recommend it. It's called Practical Buddhism. Parambandhu will be on the sofa outside. If you'd like to buy a copy, and he'll sign it. You have to buy it in the bookshop, and then he can sign it if you'd like that. But just for now, that's the end of the proceeding. Just to thank Parambandhu very much indeed.